Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name's Travis Albers, and I'm an alcoholic. Just this a little bit better, maybe. Just start off by just thanking, it takes understand and can see that putting together a roundup like this takes a lot of work and, a lot of self-sacrifice. It doesn't just happen. There's a lot of money and a lot of preparation, and really appreciate all that has been done for me, just thank you the committee for being able to put on an event. We can all get together and share experience, strength, and hope. Tyler Feeks gave me a call, and I couldn't have called at a better time there. I was at work. I was working a night shift, and man, I didn't want to be there, and I wanted to be home with my wife, and I was getting a little bit of razz from the guys at work, and he called in and just totally changed my day right around. And I probably stood, I got the message and probably sat in my chair for about 2 minutes or 5 minutes in absolute amazement. It was the longest time I paused ever. It was pretty mind blowing. I couldn't believe it. I got this joke, just maybe to start off with a little bit of humor. I could probably recite it from my memory, but I don't know if I'd like to do that. I'd probably miss the punchline or something. So, feel free to laugh, make me feel a little bit better anyway, but you don't have to. A friend forwarded me this. It says, now this is drunk. A man goes to a party and has too much to drink. His friends plead with him to let them take him home. He says no. He only lives a mile away. About 5 blocks from the party, the police pull him over. They check his license and ask him to get out of the car and walk the line. Just as he starts, the police radio blares out a notice the robbery is taking place in the house around the block. The police tell the party animal to stay put. They'll be back, and they run around the corner to the robbery. The guy waits and waits and finally decides to drive home. When he gets there, he tells his wife he's going to bed and tell anyone who might come looking for him that he has the flu and he's been in bed all day. A few hours later, the police knock on the door. They ask if Mr. Smith is there, and his wife says yes. They ask to see him, and then she replies he has been in bed all day and has been there. He's been in bed with the flu and has been there all day. The police still have his driver's license. They ask to see his car. She asks why. They insist on seeing his car, so she takes them to the garage. She opens the door, and there the police car, with lights on and everything, is sitting in this man's garage. This man told this story on his first AA meeting. I don't want to disappoint anyone, but I don't think my story is as intriguing as that would be. But I guess... I don't know if there's anyone new here today. If you probably have your attention for the next 5 minutes. I know that because I was new once and didn't really pay too much attention. But, if you're new or to the fellowship or the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you hear one thing that I have to say, I just hope that you hear that there is a solution to alcohol and alcoholism. And we can recover one day at a time, It was explained to me in the beginning. I always, why does someone come around here for 30 years? And I always thought, why doesn't this guy get it already? Can't he just, figure this thing out and start some more controlled drinking? It was explained to me, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And you take a cucumber and you pickle it and it turns into a pickle, and you can't take the pickle out of the pickle, So they said, you're pickled, and I thought, okay. Alcoholics Anonymous really has no monopoly on sobriety, but we do have program of action and recovery that has helped millions of people stay sober. You know, I'm not a reformed drinker. I don't go on crusades over drinking. You know, I just know that I cannot safely drink alcohol myself. You know, when I first got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was such a bad person. You know, I did so many horrible things, and I was just such a horrible person. I was just such a bad person, and you know, working with some people, and slowly I became to realize that I wasn't a bad person. I was a sick person. You know, but I had this hopelessness and this feeling. My life just felt absolutely hopeless and totally meaningless. You know. And that's how I felt when I came into the rooms. Now there really is a difference between communication and listening, and I hope today that maybe God can inspire and work through me, and I'll be able to communicate a message, and maybe not as it won't be the message that you hear, but you know, hopefully we'll be able to God will inspire me to say something that. So you know, some people can be able to take home from this, and it was explained to me in the beginning that Bill W. is, you know, was a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the Big Book was written with 100 men and women, and you know, it was kind of cool to see that how Bill writes. He's a very ambiguous writer, and he likes to, you know, take a number of different points try to stress an idea. He would take a number of different ways to illustrations to be able to get that point across, and I don't know about you guys, but I sure know in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that there's, and you know, we're always trying to teach in a different way, and we all learn differently, and you know, it's always better to come up with, you know, the solution stays the same and the message stays the same, but how it can be carried across can be different, you know. And you know, I was born in Stony Plain, Alberta. I born in a Catholic family. Parents, good parents. You know, we had a pretty normal upbringing. You know, I was promiscuous at a very young age. I just had so many nameless fears. You know, and I just didn't think that I could trust many people. I didn't understand, and I couldn't identify with these fears. I just know that I had so many of these nameless fears. And the first drink, you know, that the first time I drank it, it took all that away. I can't really describe it except for, you know, and that's what the first drink did for me, you know, and it took all that away, and I was able to, my skin felt like it fit, and you know, whether I fit in or not, I didn't care, you know, and that was just the way it was. And I was always so worried about what other people thought of me, you know, and the first drink took that away, and it basically distorted my perception of reality and eluded me from a reality eventually as I progressed in my alcoholism. I had an intuition very early in my, getting loaded career or drinking career that, you know, I had this profound thought. It was like, you know, if you go down this path and continue to do the things you're doing, you're going to have trouble with this for a very long time. And, you know, I, you know, it was crystal clear, and it was just immediately dispelled. And I immediately, rationalized and justified, the things that I was doing and my actions. You know, like it can't happen to me. And you know, I'm too young. I'll stop just before I lose control. You know, and all these different lies that I told myself, and maybe just to give you an illustration of where I was in my drinking, a little bit into it. I was drinking at a pub there, and before a couple days before, I was talking with a member of AA, and I was thinking, you know, planning and scheming on ways to get more and to be able to use more. And I figured, you know, if I take my truck and if I light my truck on fire, I'll be able to collect the insurance money. You know, I didn't know why I didn't sell my truck in the first place. It doesn't make sense to me, but this was a brilliant idea, you know. I figured, so if I light my truck on fire, I'll be able to collect the insurance money, and then I can go and go on this 2-week bender and just be, rolling on dubs. But I was at this pub, and I remember drinking this beer or whatever I was drinking, and it was just going down like water, and I was just pounding this stuff back, and all of a sudden I was picking fights with all my friends. I was in conflict with my brother. We were outside kind of tussling around. I remember that night I tried to call my ex-girlfriend. Poor girl, my cousin pulled up. He was a little bit late to the party, and I was always just trying to get warmed up, and I always overshot, eh? My cousin, he pulled up, and I got all this stereo equipment in my arms, eh? And I'm robbing these vehicles all around this little pub, eh? I got radars and satellite radios and a CD deck, and he's, "What are you doing?" I didn't really know, and I asked him if I could put this stuff in his truck, and that's all I remember. The night I woke up at a buddy's place, and I was looking for my truck, and I didn't know where I put my truck, eh? So I figured it must have been stolen. So I called the cops, and I reported it stolen. I filled out a police report. I called the insurance company and reported it stolen with them. And then I was at an AA meeting that night, and the guy that I was told I would start my truck on fire and collect the insurance money, I told him I lost my truck, and he said, "Well, there was a white GMC. It was the truck I was driving at the time." And he said, "That was on fire just last night in front of, there was a white GMC. I don't know if it was yours, but it was on fire in between Stony and Spruce." And I'm thinking, oh no, what did I do, man? So I didn't want to, make any, I didn't want to go over there or nothing, so I just kept looking for my truck, and my truck turned up 3 days later. I found it. It was way down a back alley and a number of blocks away from my friend's house there. But this is the insanity. I just didn't really have a clue, and I was just trying to have fun, just trying to have fun, and made a lot of friends that night, as you can see. I couldn't handle money, I really couldn't, I'd work a number of different jobs, man. I would work everywhere. I would work on the pipelines, on the rigs, or whatever, eh? And anywhere that would pay me, and I would make a bit of money, and I would be gone, and they would have no track of me, but that's, that's the way I was. I couldn't handle money at all, I questioned, I really questioned my sanity. I questioned if I were a psychopath, because I really didn't know, I thought I was absolutely, the things I was doing, and I thought I might be a psychopath. I entered Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18 years old. I sobered up when I was 22. I'm 25 today. I've had 3 years of continuous sobriety, and thanks to the grace of God and the fellowship and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I got here, man, I couldn't tell the difference between the truth and the false. Maybe I could, maybe I just didn't care. And that was, when you're right in that, that's scary. That's a very scary place to be. I was through 4 treatment centers. Every time I went there, I was waiting for the magic wand to come over and be waved over my head and to cure me, or they'd come out with this pill and they'd give me this pill, and I would be able to drink safely again. I was waiting for the quick fix, and it never came. I thought I was supposed to get involved in this one treatment center. It was out of Calgary, and this treatment center was for a year long, and I just couldn't see myself staying sober for a year. I couldn't see it, and I thought that if I could go to treatment and if they kept me there for a year, that I would be able to get a little bit of sobriety and maybe a foundation under my feet, and I thought that I would never own anything worth anything of value anymore, because I never, as soon as I had anything, I would always sell it or give it away or pawn it, and I thought I would have to have like a bodyguard. The book talks about we thought he had to have a bodyguard to walk around with him the whole time, because he just couldn't couldn't stay sober on his own will. And that was me, you know, that was absolutely me. I lost the power of choice in drink, you know. And, you know, there was, at times there was no mental defense against the first one. I was still living with my parents at the time, and I knew I was on my last legs there. And I came home one weekend from a bender, and my dad had my bags packed, and he asked me where I wanted to go, and I didn't really know. He took me to the homeless shelter, the Herb Jameson Center downtown. And I just remember when he dropped me off, he was crying, and we were both crying, and you know, I didn't know what was going on, and I really wanted to stop, but at that time, I really couldn't, you know. And that was the first time that I realized that this is serious, and I probably lost the power of choice, you know. I stayed in the homeless shelter for 7 months. They had a treatment deal there or whatever, and you know, I followed the program. I went into transitional housing, and I went back out again after 7 months. My last drink, I was actually attending school. It was shortly after that. I was attending NAIT. I was a first-year millwright at NAIT and studying. And I got through a couple of weeks of the course, and I was, you know, off to the races again. I found myself in a crack shack downtown in someone's basement. There were guys that were beating me up. I was threatened that I was going to get tied up in a basement and raped. Everyone was carrying knives, and you know, I come to the door and I'd get my face beat up, and you know, I just couldn't, all this stuff, man, and I couldn't stop from going to this place, because that's, you know, that's where I got loaded, you know. And I'm an alcoholic, but when I drink, it distorts my perception of reality and inevitably leads me to drugs, you know. And I had to come to the source, and you know, I'm an alcoholic, but when I drink, it distorts my perception of reality, and it inevitably leads me back to that first drink, you know. I pulled a job from the Millwrights Hall. I'm a member with the Millwrights Hall, and I actually went to work in Medicine Hat. I had to get out of the city. I just figured, you know, maybe the geological cure or whatever would fix me, and I took off to Medicine Hat. This guy, he picked me up. You know, I didn't have a vehicle. I didn't have a penny to my name, and I remember he picked me up, and he drove me down there. You know, he put my room on his credit card. He you know, bought me groceries. He took me to work every day with him. And, you know, I was just like, how do you find a guy like this? You know, and I knew him a little bit, but he knew a little bit about me, and he knew a little bit of where I was going, and a couple things that I've been through. And just out of the goodness of this guy's heart, he kind of trusted me and was giving me another chance, you know. And I'd go to work 5 days a week, and I'd walk to a meeting every day. It was a 20-minute walk, and I'd walk to a meeting every night, and you know, I'd change the garbages and wash the coffee cups at the end, and then I'd walk back. And it was winter time, and sometimes it was snowing, and I just knew I had to go to a meeting, you know. I found this one guy, and he wanted me to write down, you know, how the first time I drank, you know, why I drank, how it made me feel. He wanted me to write down halfway in my drinking career, you know, how it escalated, how it made me feel, why I drank, what was the outcome, you know, for the first time I drank, the middle, and the last time I drank. And I was able to see the disease as it's described in the big book. I was able to see it progress in my life. I was able to see the obsession of the mind, you know, taking over, and I was able to see how the allergy works. That once I put it into my body, you know, it becomes virtually impossible to stop. So I couldn't stay sober because of my mind, and I couldn't stop because of my body, and I was absolutely powerless over alcohol. You know, I like to, it was described to me in the beginning, you know, we have a daily reprieve, you know, contingent on our spiritual condition, and it's almost like, you know, we're sick people, but we can recover from this disease, and it's almost like a person with diabetes. You know, you can't see it, but you just know it's there, you know, and they just need to get their daily insulin, you know. And that's what it's like for me. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is my daily insulin that allows me to stay sober one day at a time. And you know, I stopped running from everything and all this chaos that I was creating in my life, and it's almost like the avalanche. You know, you can run and run and run, and then all of a sudden you run out of breath and you can't run no more, and you stop, and this avalanche just covers you. You know, and life wasn't peachy for me when I first sobered up. You know, I wasn't the greatest thing, but I had a lot of stuff going on. You know, and that's just the way things went. You know, so lack of power was my problem, and I had to find a power, you know, in which I could live. I was then told to write a wanted higher power ad, you know, and you know, I believed in God. I was raised in a Roman Catholic home, but you know, my God wasn't working for me, you know, so I had to come up with a new one. So I started writing this wanted higher power ad, and I actually found it there the other day. I've added a couple things to it, and if you don't mind, I'm gonna just read out a couple things. I had been involved in AA, you know, for a number of years, and I was trying to get this thing, and I knew I seen that other people were doing it, you know, so it gave me a little bit of hope that if you can get sober doing it this way, then maybe I could, you know, and I just wanted to try and hone my beliefs to what the big book believed, you know, and maybe then I could get sober. And you know, I my beliefs of God are a lot different today than they were when I came in. And a friend says, you know, I believe in a God today that doesn't forgive me, you know, and you kind of think, well, why would you believe in a God that doesn't forgive you? And he says, because he didn't condemn me in the first place, you know, and I think that's 100% the truth, you know, and you know, we make our own problems, and you know, we really, I do it to myself, you know, I do it to myself, and I kind of like that. And there's so many different things that if a guy becomes honest, willing, and open-minded, you know, this program can take you so many different places. But I wrote down, wanted higher power must discipline me to recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, to change my feeling, attitude, and outlook on life, to provide an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, to seed honesty, willingness, and open-mindedness, must create opportunity to be a productive member of society. I never thought I could ever be a productive member of society, you know, and that was important to me. Must be all-inclusive, never exclusive. I was sick and tired of all the debates. What's right? What's wrong? This religion is right. That's wrong. And I was just sick and tired of it. You know, I wanted just to believe in a God that was all-inclusive, never exclusive, you know. Willingness to face my problems in the light of AA's experience, a power that speaks to me through others, people, and leads me to a place safe and protected. I would like to believe in a power that inspires me to place the needs of others ahead of my own, that will be with me in all my activities when I ask, a power that is understanding and has a sense of humor, gives me the ability to tell the difference between the truth and the false, that helps my peace of mind and prosperity, a power that inspires me with intuitive thoughts, that reminds me to pause when agitated or doubtful, to place awareness in my recovery that I know I'm not running the show, and constantly remind me to say to myself, "Thy will, not mine, be done." I believe in a power that could and would if you were sought, and you know, I believe that God will do for me what I can't do for myself, you know, you people, a number of AA members, you know, they just asked me a question point blank, you know, do you now believe or are you willing to believe? And it really is can be that simple, you know. So I, you know, even though like I wrote down my characteristics of my higher power, I really thought that I found God, you know, but I really didn't find God. I just thought that I did, you know, and I found God later on in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was able to, and maybe not even God, maybe it was this power, you know, and really step two is not about God. It's just about finding a power, and lack of power was my dilemma. And I had a step one experience, you know, and I became open-minded, you know, and I was willing to grasp on anything, you know. I really had two alternatives, you know, and you know, I can go on, I can accept spiritual help because I honestly wanted to and was willing to make the effort, or else I can continue to go the way I was going. And that way, you know, I knew that nothing good was to come of it, you know. And my friend in AA, that he just describes it in a way, you know, it was almost like a fork in the road. You know, I could, I didn't know where the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were taking me, but I just didn't know it was directly off the cliff I was taking myself, you know, and that was good enough for me. You know, I was happy with that. I came in, I had two misconceptions. One, I thought that I knew what God was, and I really didn't, and I thought I knew, you know, what an alcoholic was, and those really were two huge misconceptions that, you know, that I have a lot better understanding of what that is today. I was explained, you know, there really is two Alcoholics Anonymous. There is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I tried to stay sober on for the past 3 or 4 years of trying to get sober, and I couldn't do it. You know, I had to get involved in working the 12 steps, and I had to get my feet moving and to get to work. And you know, they asked me, you know, either God is everything or He is nothing, you know, and what is my choice to be? And, you know, these things are so simple, how the book talks about these things, and you know, simple, not easy. You know, it's just the solution is simple, but it's not easy. You know, the minute I was able to see, you know, it talks about in page 60 to 63 of our big book, and the minute that I was finally able to see how I can be the actor and how I can control and manipulate things, you know, in my own life. And it wasn't just, you know, lip service, or it wasn't just, you know, I'm saying I got it, but I really don't. I was able to actually see it in my day to day living and in my actions and how I'm dealing with things. And that was incredible to me, you know, because that was just the hugest thing, man, you know, because you can't fix nothing. You can't see, right? And I was finally able to see that, you know, and I thought that was the most coolest thing, you know. I was the alcoholic who prayed and just expected, you know, God to do the work for me. You know, the third step prayer says, you know, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as I will. And, you know, this is 50-50 deal. You know, God's not going to do for me what I can't do for myself. And I really needed to do the things and take responsibility for myself. The toughest thing in recovery was to get sober doing it someone else's way, you know, because I had all these ideas, man. I had all these different plans and designs for my life, and I would come up, it's almost like being in the ring, being in the ring with King Alcohol, you know, and I'd come up with this idea, and I'd go around with King Alcohol, and he'd knock my ass out, and I'd be on the ground, and you know, I'd be out for a little bit, and all of a sudden, you know, no mental defense, and I lost the power of choice, and there I go again. I got this other idea on how to recover, and once again I'm knocked out, and that's, you know, that's the way it was. And I really, the toughest thing I think in recovery was to do it, you know, someone else's way, because, you know, you get involved in, and they say, you know, you got to get a sponsor, and how does this guy know me? You know, like, what does this guy know? He's never known me. I got to call this guy. I didn't even know him, and I got to follow his advice. Like, what is this thing, you know? But that was really tough for me. And the foundation of steps 1, 2, and 3 were absolutely critical. I really didn't know what my will in my life was. And it was until I went through up to step 7, and I had a bit of a better understanding of what my will in my life really was. There really is a difference between belief and faith. And faith and trust, you know, and I heard one time that say a guy picks up a newspaper and he sees on the front page that this guy's a tightrope walker, and he walks across skyscrapers in Edmonton, and you know, you go to that place on the belief that this guy can walk across these skyscrapers, right? And you see him do it, once, and you know, okay, well, you know, let's see it do it again, and then he does it again, and now you have faith that he can do it again. You know, first you're going on belief, Now you see him do it a couple times. Now you have faith he could do it. And he grabs a wheelbarrow and he says, you think I can do it? And he walks this tightrope on this wheelbarrow, you know. And you have faith he can do it. You've seen him do it. And then he asks you, well, do you trust I can do it? And you say, well, yeah, I trust you can do it. And he says, well, jump in, you know. So so there's a big difference between belief and faith and faith and trust. And, by this time, I'm almost, I'm coming back from Medicine Hat, and, you know, I got to keep going, because I would just do the 1-2-3 shuffle, you know, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and I would stop at 4, or I would stop at 9, and I wasn't able to stay sober. I knew I had to get more, and I would try to do this step 4, and I made huge progress, and it was absolutely incredible. Part of my recovery, just sitting down, you know, one alcoholic with another, you know, with my sponsor at the time, and to go through this step 4 process, I was able to write down my angers or my fears, you know, what the cause was, how it affected me. I was able to see, you know, how these things affected me, and then finally, I was able to see my part. You know, I was able to finally see my part. I'm telling you, I couldn't see it. You know. I couldn't see it for the life of me. I tried, and it was all that guy's fault, you know. And I would be blaming, and my fingers would be pointing all over the place, and you know, resentment is a reoccurring feeling, you know. And as it reoccurs, and it becomes, I'm able to turn it into from a mountain into a molehill really quick, or a molehill into a mountain real quick. And these feelings that I had, you know, they're real. But they're just irrational, you know, like but fancied or real, they had the power to actually kill me, you know, and I had to be rid of them. And I was finally able to see some truth and some facts, you know, because my drinking was really but a symptom, and I had to get down to the causes and conditions, you know, so getting down to more of the facts, I was able to see, and begin to take responsibility and not be the victim all the time, you know, because all the time, man, I was just walking around and always playing the victim, always, you know, it was always done to me, and I was always pointing the finger, and, you know, my sponsor told me, you know, victims don't recover, and I couldn't afford to be a victim, you know, more, and, you know, I experienced enough pain, and I really wanted to get sober, and so I really tried to begin to take responsibility for my own actions, and that was a big step. You know, that was a huge beginning, just to be able to do that, you know. I would call him on a couple different occasions, and this guy did that to me, and he said that to me, and, oh, well, you know, you don't have to be so oversensitive, you know, but this guy hurt my one feeling, you know, and, you know, I was able to see that I was an alcoholic a little bit, you know, on a deeper level. I was able to see that, you know, I'm not so unique as I thought I was, you know, and I thought nobody could understand how I feel, you know, and I was able to see that I just wasn't so unique. Beginning to see a little bit of patterns, you know, in my actions and thinking, and you know, I was starting to analyze my motives for doing things a little bit more, you know. I would always assume things, you know. I would always read minds. I don't know if you guys do this every once in a while, but I'm a mind reader, eh? And I would make these assumptions, and it was shown to me in the back of the book, you know. There's one man who, one principle who will hold a man in everlasting ignorance, and that principle is contempt prior to investigation, you know. And that just brought me to. You know, don't judge a book by its cover. You know, don't just assume things until you know the facts, until you absolutely are 100% sure. You know, and that gets me out of trouble sometimes, you know. And I thought that was pretty cool. I was able to see a little bit better why I thought the way I thought and why I acted the way I acted, you know. A number of times I would put everyone on pedestals, you know. My sponsor and a couple of people in my home group, you know, I would put these people on pedestals, and they're only human, you know, and they're not perfect, and they're going to fail. But when they failed, I would be absolutely devastated. But I was able to see that it's not right to put these people on pedestals, and my real reliance must be on God, you know. And I was able to see that in this fourth step, you know. I was able to see numerous times that I placed myself in a position to be hurt, you know, based on self. You know, I made decisions based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. Time and time again, man, it was a lot of it coming down to selfishness, you know. Expectations, I had such high expectations of everyone and of myself. And I had to begin to be a little bit more accepting of people, you know, places. To not take myself so seriously all the time, you know, to be able to just go about my day and be able to laugh at some of my mistakes that a guy makes or just to cut up and have fun. And I was given, it's outlined, there's a prayer for fear and a prayer for anger. I was able to finally see in the book and be able to recite these prayers every once in a while, you know, when these things would crop up and judgment, I would judge people, you know, and I was absolutely terrified because I was scared. I was just a bad person because I would judge these people. And if I wanted to get sober, I had to quit judging for some reason. That's what I thought. And I'm telling my sponsor, I'm talking to my sponsor about this stuff. And he says, judgment is a natural human instinct. And in order to judge, everyone judges, you know, and everyone does judge. It's wrong for me to get to a place where I'm condemning and criticizing people, you know, but the judgments I have are absolutely, you know, everyone judges, you know, and I need to judge the healthy people, towards the non-healthy people in order for me to stay sober, you know? So this is an important thing that I need to do. And it really can get off track if I start criticizing or condemning people. A friend talks about, he says that he sees people in more shades of gray, you know, and we're all children of God, and we each have the right to be here. Nobody's higher or nobody's lower, you know. We just start to see things in a little bit more shades of gray, and you know what other people think of me is none of my business, you know. And I was able to see like these facts and this truth about myself was you know incredible. It was a good beginning to recovery. And I always thought about myself, you know, occasionally I thought what you were thinking about me, you know, but usually it was, it was all about me. I was in Medicine Hat there 1 year later and the first year it was okay because I just needed to work and I was on fire watch. That was my duty. Hey, so my second year back, I was a year sober now, and I'm thinking I'm going to get all the good jobs. And you know what? They put me on fire watch again, you know? So I call my sponsor. They got me on fire watch, and I'm just pissed off. And he says, you know, he talked me down and kind of calmed me down and said the right things. I went back to work the next day, and I said, I talked to the foreman. I said, you know what? I'm going to be the best damn fire watch you ever seen, you know? And the next day I wasn't a fire watch, you know, he had me on tools and I got to work on all different kinds of, doing alignments and bearings and conveyors. And I thought that was pretty damn cool, to be able to talk about these secrets, because our secrets keep us sick, you know, and in order to be able to get this stuff out in the light, and to be able to just get some truth, you know, was absolutely incredible. And that's, I think that's, you know, if a guy comes in here and he's contemplating whether he's a psychopath or not, or that has the ability to differentiate between the truth and the false, but to get these facts out on the table was just a huge part for my sobriety. We all have natural desires. It's when these desires exceed what they're meant to be. You know, that's when I get myself into quite a bit of trouble. I continue to pray for willingness to relieve me of my character defects, and continually reminded, you know, the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between someone who's willing to look at themselves and to question their motives and their natural desires and to try and look for these instincts that over exceed what they're supposed to, you know, and I just continue to pray for the willingness to do that. Working the steps are uncomfortable for me, you know, and a lot of times it's just a different way of looking at things. It's a different way of dealing with things, and it's almost like asking a fish to jump out of the water and walk across the desert. You know, it's just 100% unnatural for me, and that's what it was like. I told my sponsor a couple times, you know, Mike, if I could have done it alone, I probably would have, but I couldn't, and I really needed your help, and I tried, you know, I really tried, and no offense, but I wouldn't be here if I didn't have to be, you know, and I proved myself time and time again, man, that I needed to be here, you know, and if I could stay sober by myself, I would have, and no offense to anyone in this room or anyone, but that's the truth, you know, and I'm sure if you're honest with yourself, you could probably say the same thing, but I try and keep things simple, and it really comes down to my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, and my fear, you know, and try and continue to watch for these things, you know. God is able to do amazing things in my life once I become willing to help him help me, you know. He begins to turn these liabilities into priceless assets, you know, and I'm able to see, begin to change through these steps, and I'm able to see that you know, even some of my bad things are assets to other people. You know, how can I relate with anyone? God's not going to make me perfect, you know, and why would he? Because I couldn't relate to nobody, you know. And I keep making mistakes and doing these things and questioning why I did this, because when I figure that out, I'm better able and more useful to other people, you know. The solution is simple, but it's not easy, you know. There's this battle between two wolves. There's this native Cherokee Indian and his grandson, and he's telling his grandson a story, and he says that, you know, there's this battle between inside a man, and it's a battle between two wolves, and there's the one wolf, and he's fighting fierce, and he's got a bunch of anger, fear, resentment, you know, jealousy, dishonesty, and he's fighting against this other wolf, and this other wolf is purity and love and compassion and self-sacrificing, and the grandson's looking at his grandpa, and he goes, "But grandpa, which one wins?" And the grandpa looks down at his grandson, and he says, "The one you feed, you know." And isn't that the truth? You know, the wolf that wins for me is the one that I feed, and the one that I continue to feed with the good and the love and the self-sacrificing and that's the one that seems to be more predominant in my life. So I'm beginning to pray for the willingness to make some of these amends that I have to make, and no matter what, I gotta be willing. Whether a guy's going to jail, whether a guy's got to do whatever, as long as I'm willing to make these amends, and I got this list, and my amends list comes from my step four, and I'm on my way to go make some amends, and in the first little bit, you know, that my amends process was pretty simple, you know. I just started showing up to work, you know, and that was a big step for me. I started to pay my bills, you know, because I never used to do that. I'm just coming off IFS actually with my insurance company, middle of May. So that's, you know, I've been on IFS for 3 years. That's a 20% higher premium, and I just never paid the insurance company. You know, I didn't think that I needed to pay them. And for months on end, you know, I would just be in my delusional state and all loaded, and I didn't pay my insurance company. You know, I stopped putting empty envelopes in the bank machine, trying to trick them that I was able to take out some money, you know, and it, in the beginning, it was all simple stuff, you know, but But it was big stuff for me, and I started to pay off creditors because I owed a bunch of money to creditors, and I was driving my dad's car to work one morning. I was between cars and between jobs at the time, and I hit this guardrail. I was actually smoking in his car, and he told me not to smoke in his car, but what can I do? You know, I'm not perfect, and I'm smoking in his car. And I throw this cigarette butt out the window, and it lands in the back seat. So I'm looking in the back seat, trying to find this cigarette butt, and I smash right in this guardrail, man. It folds the car, like, right up. I'm lucky to be alive. I broke my sternum, and I was able to pay for my dad's car. You know, I was able to say, you know, I wrecked your car, and here's $2,500, you know, and I would have never done that had I been loaded, you know. I don't know if you guys can relate, but I used to steal, and I'm a thief, you know. I'm a hard thief, and it was, some of it was pretty petty stuff, but I would steal these water bottles from IGA and Co-op, and I would, you know, I would walk out the door and I would empty them, and then I would bring them back for $20, you know, and I was able to go out with a couple of buddies and go a night on the town with these $20 water bottles, and I was able to go back to the Co-op and IGA and admit my wrong and to give them restitution and stop stealing water bottles, you know. So I'm not a water bottle thief anymore, you know. But there was one time I was at the registries and I had a speeding ticket, you know, and I blew up on this girl at the clerk gate and this girl at the counter, and you know, it was all her fault, and I'm the victim, and I was able to go back with her and to say that how I reacted to that situation was wrong, you know, and every time I go in there, I'm reminded, because I don't want to make these amends again, you know, and I'm reminded that, oh, I better just pause one more second, you know, before I open my mouth, you know, and I'm able to get a little bit more clarity in how I react to things. I started giving charity donations to maybe some amends that I was willing to make some amends, and my sponsor pulled the reins back on me, and again I got to do things. I can't continue to do things my way, so I listened and I started making donations to different charities. I started to volunteer some time at the church. 6 months later, I was filling out this late registration form, and I was actually, you know, I was volunteering with the church, and then all of a sudden I was unable or unqualified to volunteer with the church, and that hurt deep. I had a talk with a youth counselor, and I told him that I was gonna, you know, pursue this, and I was gonna fight this, because, you know, I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I really enjoyed the sacrifice that I was able to give. I just felt a lot better the couple hours of service that I was able to do there, but at the time I told him I was going to get more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to throw myself harder into maybe things that I can do there in the time. And you know, 6 months later I was back and able to you know, get into service again with the church, and I thought that was pretty cool. It was something that I really loved to do, and I really got a lot out of in the time. I started writing letters to my mom and my dad, and I was writing these letters to my parents. I remember just tears, man, just tears rolling down my face, I was able to take them out for dinner. I took my dad to a hockey game, and I got him a nice card, and I gave him this letter, you know, and he just says he's so proud of me, and you know, we've got to give him a hug, and I took my mom out for dinner and gave her a letter, just these things, these moments that a guy is able to experience and really feel some love, you know. There were times when I would call my sponsor, and you know what my family did, and you know what my mom did, and he would just say, you know, look at all the love, you know, look at all the love, and you know, thanks for that, you know, because I was surrounded by lots of love, you know, and I just couldn't understand a lot of times. I was in a shopping, whether it was Walmart or whatever, but I was looking at these cards for some reason. I seen this one card that had this herd of sheep, eh? And there was one black one in the middle. And I thought, well, there's me and the black sheep, eh? You know. But it was no secret. You know, my family all knew that I was the black sheep of the family, and they knew that I thought that. Hey, they knew that's the way I felt, you know, and I just remember my grandparents, they would pray for me and pray for me and pray for me. And it was just so incredible that their devotion for prayer. And I just wanted to maybe just to give them this card and to tell them that I don't feel like a black sheep no more. And just to, you know, say some really kind words. And I was able to give my grandma and grandpa a hug and to tell them I love them. And I would have never done that had I been drinking either or been loaded, you know. There's a couple of relationships, a relationship with my dad and with my sister that there was a lot of pain, you know, there was a lot of pain, and these were probably, you know, the closest relationships that were hurt the most. And those relationships today are the strongest relationships I have, you know, and that's not me, you know, that's the power that I found. That's got to be a God, you know, and my parents are the most self-sacrificing people that I know, you know. They are they're very selfless people, and I'm able to see that. You know, I got married September 26th, 2009, to my beautiful wife here in the front, and that was an incredible day, you know, and I would have never been there. You know, I would have missed it all. You know, and my parents were able to be there and to experience that. And I think there was just this healing power that was there, you know, and my dad told me after, he just explained this feeling of this power or whatever that was there. And it was just this healing effect that he was able to feel, you know. And I was with one of my older brothers on a canoe trip, you know. It was on a stag, and my older brother, he shows up with a cooler full of beer and hard alcohol, no food, eh? And I'm thinking, oh no, you know, like, well, at least you got your priorities straight, you know. At the end of the canoe trip, I had had enough, and I probably said a couple things that you know, I regret a little bit today, but maybe God was using me as an instrument, you know, as someone to bring a little bit of truth and someone to show him, or not show him, but just to be able to, I don't know. And I'm working with my sponsor on it. I'm thinking, you know, I should be making amends. And he says, you know, this is the way it is right now. And you know, but, you know, I would have never been able to go on this canoe trip and to be able to stay sober without the help that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've heard a number of times in AA, the biggest amends I owe is to myself, you know, and that's not true for me, you know, but the amends that I make to other people and the people that I have harmed, that's the byproduct of making amends to myself, you know, and you know, that if that's my number one sole objective, then I'm on the wrong path, you know. Really, you know, I pray for the willingness, and as I become willing, 100% willing, and I'm ready to do some of these amends, I gotta really be conscious and paying attention to what my sponsor has to say, because sometimes I can provide more harm than I'm doing good, you know. And even though I'm willing to make some amends just don't need to be made, you know. And maybe they don't, and maybe it's just not time yet, you know. Maybe it's just not time. Continue to be able to take personal inventory, and I don't know why anyone would want to do that unless they've experienced a little bit of freedom, you know, from the remaining steps, and I guess I got to continue this stuff, you know. We don't graduate, and You know, yeah, it's a continued deal, I guess. And I had a misconception before of what freedom was, and I always thought freedom was being able to do anything you wanted, whenever you wanted. And I don't believe that today. I believe it's almost like a train on the tracks, and the train is on a path, you know, and the train is doing what the train is supposed to be doing. You know, the train is on the path. If the train jumps off the track and starts going, making his own, blazing his own trail, the train's not going to be very free, you know? And that's almost like what it's like for me. You know, if I'm blazing my own trail and doing, following my own ideas and doing exactly the way I think I should be doing, you know, and not following or seeking, God or you know, following what's written in the book, you know, I'm not going to be very free, you know? This whole thing is almost like, we're in just this big rock tumbler, you know, and the steps, you know, over time, you know, we kind of, the fellowship, we're clashing together and you know, we start to knock off the rough edges on our, you know, that we're each individual rocks, and we start to grind off these rough edges and we add the steps, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're starting to shine a little bit, you know, and we're smooth and shiny rocks, you know. It's almost like that. I don't know. I would always read this line in Step 10, and you know, we begin to grow in understanding and effectiveness in others, and I always wonder, you know, like, what does that mean? You know, how do we grow in understanding and effectiveness of others? And I think, and I'm not saying I know what that means, but I'm just saying I think I know what that means. And what it means to me right now is that, you know, as I make mistakes and as I continue to question the path that I'm on, I'd be able to grow in understanding and effectiveness for others, you know, and be able to hone how I can carry this message. And you know, maybe I didn't react the way I should have, or maybe I should have done this. And you know, those are the results of, I guess, of step 10 and 11. And you know, step 10 promise, you know, we begin to feel like we've been placed in a position of neutrality, you know, safe and protected. I never felt safe. I never felt protected when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes I just think that, like, I don't really have time to meditate, but you know, that my day goes so much better when I'm actually able to take a couple of minutes out of the day and to pause, to continue to ask for guidance and strength, and my day goes so much better. There really isn't an end to this. It's, you know, all inclusive. If I'm getting bored in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm not seeing the picture, I don't think. Hey, and I've just been able to see so many incredible things and be able to, you know, be able to experience, just loads of different avenues a guy can get into and to become a little bit more of service or it really is an AA kindergarten for me to spirituality. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is really, you know, we're not this huge spiritual giant. It's really an AA kindergarten. I was in Millwright class here, and I was doing this alignment, or studying how to do an alignment. And you know, I got 95% on the theory part, and I get into the shop, and I'm supposed to do this alignment, and I should know how to do this alignment, and I got 95% theory, and I can't do this alignment, you know, and pretty much the instructor was able to kind of guide me and which tool to pick up at the time in order to put it into action. And that's exactly what a sponsor is for me, you know, because I can have 100% knowledge in the big book and know 100% of what I'm supposed to do and not know how to apply it, you know, into my daily life today. You know, God willing, I'll be a fourth year apprentice at the end of this year. In this last year, you know, I've been able to experience and go to a couple of AA roundups. I went to an AA men's retreat in Jasper. That was, you know, the most serene spot that I've been to in the mountains. I was able to spend some time in BC with my wife's family. You know, I went to Mexico right after completing my third year apprenticeship at Nate. I went to Mexico with my wife and my family. You know, today I own my own home and I haven't defaulted on any of my payments. You know, that's incredible. You know, for me, that's a huge deal. You know, at our we choreographed our first dance, you know, and it went absolutely, like, we actually, you know, we practiced, we put about 6 hours or whatever into this first dance, and we paid for someone to kind of watch us and step through our first dance at our wedding, and you know, I wouldn't trade that for nothing, because it was fun. It was a little bit nerve-wracking and frustrating at times, but the end result, it was pretty incredible. I did a couple of home rentals at my house, and I was able to, you know, a couple, my dad and myself and a couple of Milan's brothers and sisters came over and built a deck at my wife's place. Went on a honeymoon to Bali, Indonesia, you know, and for 10 days or a week, and we got to spend 3 days in Vancouver, you know, before we went with my cousins. You know, I got to get a little bit more active in my home group and in District 10. We got this cool deal going on right now. It's a PI committee, a public information, where we got two schools that we're supposed to speak to, two high schools, and you know, we got a couple of members on the committee there, and that's just, you know, one of the most inspiring things, and something that gives me so much more motivation and to be able to give back and to be able to you know, say that there is a solution and maybe lay down a couple of the spiritual tools, you know, for these high school kids. My wife was pregnant for 9 months, actually, you know, that's how long it takes, I guess. And I didn't know how anyone could ever think a pregnant woman is beautiful. You know, I just didn't understand it at once and at first. And you know, we're driving from Banff, my cousin's wedding there, and I'm looking at my wife, and she's just going to give birth in like a couple weeks time, and you know, I got tears running down my eyes, and I can only look at her and say that she's the most beautiful woman that I've ever seen, you know, and I absolutely 100% felt that, you know, and she, I just didn't understand, you know, and my wife was the most beautiful pregnant woman that I've ever seen, you know. We have a newborn baby. She was born March 25th, 11:44 a.m. She was 8 pounds, 6 ounces. Her name's Vienna. She's just a beautiful girl, and you know, we're going to get to do so many cool things together, you know, and it's just really the beginning. Peace of mind is a priceless gift, and you know, alcoholics get to experience great suffering and great love, you know, and I've experienced just a tremendous amount of love, and I'm so proud of her, you know. I'm so proud of both of them, and all this that's I've been able to do and experience and be a part of, you know, and I want more. I just want more, you know. I want to be able to work with one alcoholic, with another alcoholic, you know, and that's really how it begins. I want to be able to give this away, you know. It was described, you know, there's an alcoholic, he's walking down this street, and he falls into this pit, and you know, this huge pit, and he can't get out, and he looks up, and there's a doctor there, and he's asking for help, and this doctor's writing him a bunch of prescriptions, and he throws him down in the pit, and he says, you know, when you get out, you know, get your leg looked at and fill these prescriptions, you'll be okay. The doctor can't help him. He goes on his way, right? There's a lawyer that walks by, and he says, you know, this pit shouldn't be here in the first place. I don't know why you fell down here. Throws his card down there and says, you know, when you get out, we're going to get a lawsuit on this guy, you know, and give me a call. There's a priest that walks by, and the priest, you know, gives him a sign of the cross, says a prayer, and you know, he really all he can do. He's got to give a service in 10 minutes, so the priest goes on his way, and there's an alcoholic that's walking by, and he sees the man down in the pit, and he jumps down in the pit with him, and the guy looks at him like he's absolutely nuts, and the guy says, you know, what are you doing down here? You know, and this guy looks at him and he says, you know, I've been here before and I know the way out. You know, if I want to get my car fixed, I go to a mechanic. If I want to, you know, get surgery, I go to a surgeon. If I want to recover from alcoholism, I want to talk to another alcoholic, you know, and I want to be able to give, back what I was freely given. I was just, one more thing and I'm going to be out of here. It's called, it's just a poem, and I just think it's the greatest poem. It's called The Touch of the Master's Hand. It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it hardly worth his while to waste his time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bid, good people, he cried, who starts the bidding for me? $1, $1, do I hear $2, $2, who makes it $3? $3 once, $3 twice, going for $3, but no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, what now I bid for this old violin, as he held it aloft with his bow. $1,000, $1,000, do I hear two? $2,000, who makes it $3? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The auctioneer cheered, the audience cheered, but some of them cried, we just do not understand. What changed its worth? Swift came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune, battered with bourbon and gin, its auctioneer cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like that old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game when he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and almost gone. The master comes and the foolish crowd could never quite understand the worth of the soul and the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. I think that's a pretty powerful poem, and thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this roundup, and I hope everyone enjoys their weekend, and God bless. Thank you.